When I was younger, I'd look at other people and I'd go, I'd be really happy if I was making your work. I was very self-critical, and I never really liked anything that I made in the past. And I think probably the biggest thing is, discovering a style that I actually really enjoy making.
I'm Bob Acton, and I'm pleased to introduce Georgie Gardner to you in this episode. Georgie is a wonderful potter in the UK. She studied workshop ceramics at Harrow and then ran her studio at the Chocolate Factory in Stoke Newington for 10 years before moving to Surrey, where she now has a garden studio. She creates distinctive bowls and vessels on the wheel. Each piece is unique. The decoration is cut from paper by hand and applied to the leather-hard clay before adding layers of color. The paper is then peeled back to reveal the bold graphic motifs before firing. I hope you enjoy this conversation where we talked about color, surface design, and the challenges about working with clay. All the notes will contain links to her websites and Instagram.
Welcome to Color and Ceramics, the podcast for ceramic artists who want valuable ideas about using color from leading artists and world-class experts. Here's your host, Bob Acton, a sculptor and ceramic artist who's fascinated with color and how potters, sculptors, and artists use color in their work. Tune in as he talks with his guests about color, techniques, and the impact of color on people and art itself.
Georgie, thanks so much for joining us here today on the Color and Ceramics podcast. I really appreciate you taking the time and the opportunity for us to learn more about your beautiful work that you do in the UK.
Thank you.
Yes, absolutely.
You're inviting me on.
Oh, you're most welcome. I was enthralled with the colors that you use in your work, and I'm sure that lots of people will be interested in some of the techniques that you use, although I've got your Instagram set up here on my computer. So I'm looking at it as we're chatting, and I can see that you are sharing many of your techniques on there.
Yes.
Already. So that's pretty cool. Obviously, this work that you do has taken years of hard work and consistency and so on. I wonder if you could tell us just a little bit about your journey, where you started and what you've done to get you here today.
Sure. I left school at 16, and school was horrible. I hated it. And I really didn't know what I wanted to do. So I got onto a secretarial course, and I lasted a couple of months there, and I knew I definitely didn't want to work in an office. And a friend had suggested a window dressing course, which was a BTEC diploma, a 2-year course, which I got onto, and they did half day ceramics on that course, and I found that I was spending all of my time in the ceramic department. All my window displays had some kind of element of clay. And when we had to do work experience, I went and did a week's work experience with a potter up in Nottingham. And I just fell in love with clay there. I did do clay at school, but I didn't really do anything very good at school. But it was at college that I kind of came into myself. I discovered a bit more about, the things I liked. And I discovered Lucy Rhee as well. And she had quite an impact, not just because of her work, but the fact that she was still potting in her 80s. That was a really major influence. And From then, I wanted to be a potter, and I wanted to do it forever. I didn't, want to have a job and retire from it. So from there, I did an arts foundation for a year and specialised in ceramics. And then after that, I got onto a degree course at Harrow, which was workshop ceramics. So it was a very practical degree. Learned how to, you know, dig your clay, make clay glazes, build your own kilns. And, you know, it was just an amazing time. We had lots of visiting lecturers. This was in the early 90s. So courses were free, believe it or not. And they had money for, you know, all these amazing people to come in and talk about their work, which was just incredible. I spent, you know, a lot of time mixing up my own glazes and everything, but I never really came up with anything that I, you know, I must have made up a thousand glazes, but didn't really come up with anything that I really thought I wanted to use.
I know what you mean. I've got a box. I've got probably three boxes of little test tiles in my studio where I've mixed up different things and tried them at different temperatures and firing schedules, but I never really found something that really worked for me.
No, I mean, some people, they hit on a glaze and it, you know, it just works for them. And you know, I was always looking for that kind of one glaze that, you know, was the one. And so many disappointments, you know. I'm not a big shiny person, you know. I don't like shiny glazes. You know, one aspect of Lucy Ree that I really was drawn to was, you know, her matte work with the sgraffito lines, very delicate lines in, you know, kind of the blacks. And I was, you know, very, very drawn to that. Mm-hmm.
She does have beautiful work. I too am drawn to her work, and often I'll reference that when I do very different things now, but I find myself really loving her work as well.
Yeah. I wrote her a letter once when I was young. I never posted it to her, and I regret that because she died shortly afterwards. But, you know, she was the biggest influence on me wanting to be a potter. You know, definitely.
And it sounds like that you really paid attention to what you loved and went with that, as opposed to doing something in your life career-wise that somebody said you should do versus something that you wanted.
Yeah, definitely. I feel quite lucky that, you know, it was, you know, in my about 18 that I, you know, really thought this is what I want to do. And then, you know, how do I get to that point? And everything, you know, all the college courses and everything. I was at college for quite a long time, probably about 7 years, but I knew where I wanted to get to, which was, you know, having my own studio and making my own work. I just didn't know what work that would be. That, you know, the thing with clay is there's such a variety of what you can make, which is the beauty of it, but it's quite overwhelming. And especially at university, I did a lot of chopping and changing, you know, and experimenting. We because it was workshop ceramics, it was a very practical course, and they had two solid days of throwing, production throwing. So learning how to, you know, repeat a shape. So you'd throw, you'd cut it in half, and you wouldn't be precious about anything. And that, I think that was a really important grounding. Mm-hmm. Because I've always, the wheel has always been my passion. I just, you know, find it magical. And I still find it magical, you know.
It's addictive in some ways, isn't it? You get touched by clay and you can't stop.
Yeah.
Hey, tell us a little bit about what you mean by workshop ceramics. So you mentioned that a couple of times.
That was the title of it. So I think it started in the 60s. It was quite a well-known course at Harrow, well-regarded. And I think when I went there, it was in a bit of a transition. It didn't really know whether it was still very much a practical course. You know, we made our own glazes and – you know, we had a big clay pit outside where we, you know, even in the winter, you'd have to, you know, dig your own clay and pug it back into being usable clay. And it, you know, it taught you everything you needed to know to have your own business. So you had business studies as well. So it was a very practical course. But at the time that I went, it was trying to be a bit more arty as well. So it kind of didn't know what it was. And I'm very much, you know, I don't really do art speak. You know, my pots have no greater deep meaning to them. You know, I'm quite practical. I like beauty and things. You know, I try and make beautiful work as opposed to something with deep meaning. But I think a lot of the time at university, they wanted you to, you know, have all this deep meaning to your work. And I struggled a bit with that, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've obviously hit a really great spot in your work. You have many, many followers on social media, and people love your work, and you're very successful. So good for you.
Yeah, it's funny about, you know, people love the peel and reveal videos, but I think that was in lockdown I started to post those. But, you know, up until then, I thought, you know, people wouldn't be interested in my work, because it takes so long. It would be like watching paint dry, you know. It's there's a lot of time in between, and that's the beauty of, you know, speeded up speeded up film, especially to put to nice music as well. I quite enjoy watching those back as well.
So you mentioned that it takes a long time to create your work. Can you describe for people? I'm sure people will go to your website and your Instagram site, and, you know, we'll make posts with, or we'll include all that information in show notes. But tell people a little bit about your work and what you do and how you do it.
I decorate with paper resist. And it's a technique that I've been doing for about 20 years. It's quite a simple technique in that you take paper. I now use plain newsprint, like fish and chip paper. So it's nothing special. It's not, you know, sticky. It's not plastic coated or anything. It's kind of once use only. And I cut by hand with a scalpel, either leaf shapes or, you know, stems that wrap around my pots. I apply it with water, and I do everything at the greenware stage. So it's still got, you know, a dampness to the clay, so the paper will then stick to the clay. And I decorate with ongobes that I mix up myself. So an ongobe is like a slip, but it's got a bit of flux added to it. So you know, whereas a slip, you would need a shiny glaze to bring the colour out. An ongobe has that bit of flux in it. So you can apply it like a slip. You can also apply it onto bisque as well. But I apply it like a slip, and it becomes like a skin, you know, on the clay, on the piece. And I will brush on 4 or 5 coats of, you know, thinnish colour to get that solidness. And the reason I do that is I don't want any thick brush marks. You know, I'd use a soft brush, and I'll cross hatch quite quickly, so there's no kind of text. There's a slight texture in that, and I like that. Everything is going back to when I throw them, everything is thrown, and I will apply a white ongo before I start decorating, because although I love throwing, I don't want any, you know, slight turning marks or anything like that. So I will really turn my pieces, you know, till they almost squeak, till they're like almost burnished. And then I will apply this 3 or 4 coats of white ongo, again cross hatching, so you get a blank canvas, but you get a very slight texture. So it's all, you know, I love hand built pottery, and I think the shapes that you can get in you know, hand building small bases, going, you know, flaring up. I love that kind of shape. But I love throwing. So I don't want to have, you know, I want something that's thrown. So it's the best of both worlds. Mm-hmm. You know, I throw something, but I almost make it look slightly hand built by putting this kind of slight texture on. Mm-hmm. And then I'll apply the paper, apply the coats. And you have to let each one dry in between to become touch dry before you put the next coat on. And although it's a simple technique, there's quite a lot of different things that can go wrong. And even now, I've been doing it 20 years, I still have a lot of mistakes because especially on the...
Can go wrong.
Well, especially things like the shoulders, you know, if you brush the colour on, sometimes it lifts the underneath off. And, you know, it's not until the glaze firing that it becomes apparent that it's slightly patchy. Or if you have it too thick, it can bubble. And that's those two things, there's a really fine line between, you know, it being right and it being wrong. And because it looks so simple, there's nowhere to hide any errors. You know, if it's wrong, it's wrong.
Yeah.
I'm having a real issue with the black and over the gray at the moment. So that just bubbles the whole time. So I'm trying to, you know, find a different gray. But I've spoken to other people and they have had issues with the black as well. So I don't know whether it's, you know, something has changed in the black stain that I get. I'm not sure.
It sounds like you're experiencing what a lot of potters do, is that there always seems to be a change.
Yeah. You can never become complacent with ceramics. It always keeps you on your toes. You know, if you think you've got one thing sorted, then, you know, something else goes wrong.
Yeah.
So,
You know, one of the things that's striking me as I'm listening to you talk is that you must really need to have your full attention on your work. You know, you're talking about different layers and cross-hatching and the right moisture level in each layer before you put on the next one. And I could see that for somebody who might lose their attention, that would be a difficult process. So you must really pay attention.
Yes, I do. I have a piece of paper that I, you know, mark down how many layers I've put on of each one. Because sometimes you think, oh, is that three or four? You know, so I do, I'm quite meticulous at, you know, marking down exactly how many coats I've put on. And also, you know, I've got children, so I work from home, but I, you know, have to run them off to places and everything. So if I know I haven't got a full day to, especially a larger piece, it will take me all day to decorate. I can't do it if I know I've got to be off elsewhere. So especially with my bigger pieces, I tend to apply the paper one day, which will take like a whole day to work out the pattern. And then the next, I'll cover it back over with plastic. And then the next day I'll have a full day to paint it.
It takes you a full day to do one piece?
Pretty much. I mean, it is a very long process. Because of all the drying as well. In the summer, you know, there's kind of an optimum time where things dry out kind of nicely, fairly quick, but not too quick. When it's at the height of summer, things dry out too quick, you know, and that's not good because the paper starts to peel off and everything. But then, you know, in the winter when it's damp, things take so long to dry, you know, so you can't, there's no speeding up as well. You can't start drying it with a hairdryer or anything because that would just lift the paper off. So it's, it's a simple technique, but there's a lot, you know, that can go wrong. And I think that's why I've done it for so long, is that I've never got bored with it. It's like safe jeopardy, you know, there's lots of things that can go wrong, but at the end of the day, it's just a pot. You know, it's not, so it's, it's enough of a, oh, will this, you know, will this go right? I don't know.
Yeah, that's interesting, eh? Because I think the naive person, the person who doesn't understand clay or those kind of things, will look at your work and go, oh, that probably doesn't take her very much time.
Yeah.
But in fact, what you're describing is a process that takes quite a lot of time.
But that's not the end of it as well, because I'll bisque fire, and when I get that out, I'll go over every edge just to crisp it up. Because because I apply so much colour on, when I peel the paper off, sometimes the edges can not really be jagged so much, but just slightly not as crisp as I'd like. So I go over each edge, then I glaze, fire it again, and then I'll sand everything after firing with wet and dry paper, because the Ongo tends to be quite cat's tonguey, you know, a bit rough. And I don't like that. I want them to be, you know, tactile objects, especially like the little tiny ones. I want them to be held and enjoyed. So I'll sand, and then I apply a Renaissance wax, which just protects the surface. Mm. So there's all those kind of stages after it's been fired that, to be honest, are a bit boring. I don't like glazing, but I do glaze the inside, because although I don't see it as a functional piece, I see it as a decorative piece, I want it to be functional if somebody wants to use it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I sure do. So the outside is finished with your engobe, and the inside is finished with a glaze.
Yeah.
But the outside is then finished with some wax afterwards.
Yeah, the Renaissance wax, I think the British Museum came up with it to kind of protect. I think you can put it on, you know, photographs and paintings and things like that. It doesn't give like a high sheen, but it just stops kind of finger marks and things like that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I like to, you know, I like things to be just right. And it,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, for sure.
It takes its time, but, it, you know, I have a lot of, even now, I have a lot of pieces that, you know, come out the kiln and they've bubbled or they've got a patch, you know, and then that's it, you know. It's taken you all that time to get to that point, and, you know, they just are seconds.
What do you do with your seconds? I have friends who say, oh, I'll never sell a second. I have seconds that I chuck in the bin. How about you? What do you do with your seconds?
Well, I think when they're so bad, I will just, you know, take a hammer to them, which my kids delighted a bit too much. You know, it's like, hang on a minute. But yeah, my mother-in-law has a lot of, you know, kind of hedgehog homes and stuff like that, you know, pots that, you know, were seconds. But generally now, they're kind of good enough to sell, but they're not gallery, you know, they're not so good to go to galleries. So I have open studios in June every year, so I will, you know, sell them at quite reduced prices. Which is quite nice. You know, I had some this year, and somebody bought a couple of pieces and said, oh, I didn't think I'd ever be able to afford your work, but I, you know, he was very delighted to have these slight seconds. So yeah, it was nice. Good that they go to loving homes, you know. I'm quite pleased with that.
That's right. And out in the garden to leave for a hedgehog to wander into, it sounds like. Yeah, very good. Now tell us about the color you use and why you choose the colors you do, and what kind of approach are you getting at when you're thinking of color?
Okay. The colours I use now are all on the ongobes, and then I'll use commercial stains to get the colours. When I was at university, I would do vitreous slips, which are pretty much ongobes, but I would decorate them with more oxides, so cobalt and copper and manganese, to be a bit more random, I think. But I like I like the commercial colors, but it's taken me quite a while to come up with a range that I like. When you look online and you see all these, you know, like a kid in a sweet shop, all these different colors and amazing names and everything, and you know, you try them out and like a bright orange becomes a peach or something, you know, they're quite disappointing quite a lot of the time. So it's taken me a long while. I've bought a lot of commercial stains in the past, and probably, you know, 60% of them I don't use because they didn't come out very well. But it's taken me a while to get a range that sits nicely together. I used to use kind of turquoises and a red iron oxide, but I didn't like the way they sat together. So they, you know, kind of ditched them. So it's always nice when you try a new color and it goes well with the other colors that you've got. Yeah, it's taken a while to get to a range of colours that I think work nicely together and on their own as well. Mm-hmm. My favourite combination at the moment is an emerald and a yellow. But the first time I did it, I opened the kiln and my first response was, oh, yuck. It was, you know, it was so bright. And I just thought it was horrible. And it stayed on my shelf for a while. And after a couple of months, it became my favorite piece. And I really loved the combination. And I mean, that's my favorite combination now, but I've dialed the yellow down a bit. So it's not quite so intense. So it's a pale yellow, white and emerald. And it's just beautiful together. I'm really, really pleased with that combination. That's my favorite combo at the moment.
So you work with a palette, do you? That when you're going to color your work, do you select ahead of time the palette that you want to start to work with?
Generally, I'll have an idea of, you know, what I want to do. But sometimes it will just be the white and another color, which is, you know, a fairly simple thing to decide. And then, yeah, with the other, the leaf patterns have become a bit more intricate. So, you know, I started kind of overlaying colour over colour. And generally it's a light colour underneath and a darker colour on top. And it's a bit like screen printing, where the colour you apply last is actually the background colour. And so you go from kind of light to dark. I'll work on kind of pieces for a gallery that would then sit well together. So, yeah, I generally have an idea of, you know, what colour combos to do. I'll work to commissions. People will say they want this colour or this piece in this colour, so I'm quite happy to do that. I don't have a very varied palette. It's all, you know, it tends to be kind of blues, blacks, there's a purple, green. It's quite limited. And erring on more kind of slightly muted, you know, when I decorate them and I do the peel and reveal, they're quite intense colours. I think my phone, you know, makes them look quite intense as well. But once they're fired, they're toned down a bit, which I much prefer. Yeah.
And now what do your clients say about your palette and your color? Obviously you're in lots of galleries and selling your work professionally. What kind of reaction do people have to your work?
I think the most popular colors tend to be like the sea blue and the blue gray and like black and gray. annoyingly, the black and gray is the one that I have most issues with, but that's kind of my one of my favorite combos. But yeah, I think people like the color range that I have. The emerald and yellow one that I've is my favorite at the moment. That seems to be the one that I'm making most for people at the moment, which, you know, is interesting.
Yeah, well, we make what we like, don't we? Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Hey, now, you know, this show is about color and surface design, of course, and so here we are talking about that. But there needs to be a balance in relation to the form. How do you think about the form and color and surface design in their relation to each other?
Very much, it's all one piece. The way I decorate, I like, you know, the decoration is part of the form. And I'm especially liking making like big hot air balloon type forms at the moment, smaller bases so they look like they're, you know, on tiptoes. And the big volume, you know, is great for decorating. So when I first started making them, there'd be like a front and a back, you know, it would be very obvious. But now I'm kind of intertwining them more, you know, the stem curves around the form and then interconnects. So I very much think about how the pattern will fit that shape. Which, you know, gets me quite excited, really. Yeah.
So tell us how you do that. Like, what's your methodology, I guess, in terms of how you approach the form with your work?
Well, interestingly, sometimes I don't know how the piece is going to be decorated. You know, I'll make a form and, you know, I'll kind of ask it, you know, what do you want to be like? And sometimes, you know, I'll start cutting a stem and it, you know, it just kind of, you know, sits right. Or, I mean, sometimes I cut and I recut because, you know, a flat piece going onto a three-dimensional form, you know, you want it to go down and it, you know, you wrap it around and it goes up. So it's taken me a long while to, you know, decorate on a three-dimensional piece. And there's been a lot of trial and error. And, you know, making things and going, oh, I don't like how that bit works, or I really like how that bit works, I'm going to do that again. So I don't do any sketching. I don't do, you know, because it would be easy to, you know, decorate a platter or something with cut bits of paper because it's flat. But the moment it goes on a three-dimensional piece, you know, it's taken a while to learn, well, you know, if I cut it this shape, it will then flow round. So yeah, there's a lot of trial and error. And then, you know, just patterns evolve and become more intricate, you know, and you do this and you think, oh, I could add that to it. And with the daisy ones, you know, I started off fairly simple, but then I put the extra colour on, and it's, you know, it makes this lovely kind of star shape at the top where there is no paper. So there's, you know, things like that that you discover by doing it.
Sometimes they just occur, don't they? And then in a kind of organic way.
Yeah.
And then you can remember that because you keep meticulous notes.
Yeah. Yeah. And also because I film everything peeling off, if somebody wants something that's similar, I can rewatch the video and see how it looks all the way around. So, you know, I have, it's a record as well as, you know, being something fun to look at.
Yes, that's really a smart thing to do. I think the notion of keeping track of what you do, and, you know, you were talking about how many layers do I put on, and I keep track of, that's a smart thing. I'm going to remember that because I sometimes run into that myself. But I think the idea of tracking and keeping records is Very smart. And the other thing that I love that I hadn't thought of before is to video record each of those things as well, so that you can go back and reference it for yourself.
Yeah.
What a great idea. Yes, absolutely. So you've talked a little bit about some of your challenges that you've had with some of the new stains that you're getting, right? You said the black's just not quite working and the gray's not just quite working. And some of the challenges that you've had with figuring out how to cut a piece, particularly like your stems of your plants, right? So that they flow around the piece effectively. What, as you've developed this style, what would you say is your biggest challenge and how did you overcome that?
I think the biggest challenge is, you know, what I've talked about, the bubbling and the patchiness, and I'm not sure I have overcome that yet. You know, it's always striving for, you know, this elusive perfection. I think when I was younger, I'd look at other people and I'd go, I'd be really happy if I was making your work. You know, I was very self-critical and I never really liked anything that I made in the past. And I think probably the biggest thing is, you know, discovering a style that I actually really enjoy making. I still am quite self-critical, and sometimes, you know, I'll get a piece out and think, oh, that's dreadful. But sometimes I'll get out a piece and I'll be really proud, you know, and go, yeah, you know, that's good. I've got a couple of pieces on my shelf, actually, that I don't want to get rid of yet. You know, I don't want to sell because, you know, I think, especially with the decoration, quite often, you know, it's nice from a couple of angles, but then, you know, there's one that's not, you know, quite right. Or and the one on my shelf, it looks nice from every angle. And I think, you know, that I probably can't make anything as nice as that ever again.
So that piece is staying home.
So, you know, I've put a huge price on that one. So, you know, I don't really want to sell it.
Hey, now tell me, you've said that you can be self-critical, and yet you have still worked away at it to make it great. Yeah. Many people would have given up. They let that self-critical component overwhelm them in some ways. What has helped you not let that critical voice in our head win the battle? What's kept you in the game?
Well, I mean, potters in general have to be resilient because you do get a lot of knocks. You know, you get you get a lot of things that go wrong. And actually, when I left university, I went and worked in a studio called The Chocolate Factory in East London, and there were about 20 artists there. And it was a great time, and I was making work. I was still decorating with Ongos, but I was making ceramic lighting. So hand-built bases, throne shades. And I would have, I'd have a 3-foot by 3-foot kiln that would take months of work. And, you know, you'd have a disastrous firing where everything went wrong. So there were a lot of tears and a lot of times when, you know, you just thought, oh, what am I doing? And actually, I left there when I was expecting my first child. So she's now 18. But I didn't want to touch clay ever again. It's like, I'm done with it. I'd had so many, you know, things go wrong. And actually, for 4 years, I didn't touch clay. And I just immersed myself in motherhood. And it was only when she started school, and it was a very arty school, and the headmistress discovered that I, you know, was a potter, and I helped them buy a kiln and glazes and clays and went in and volunteered there. And it was only through the kids' enjoyment of making clay that, you know, then reignited my, you know, passion again. And actually I got the kids like really lovely white earthenware and the nice Amoco velvet underglazes in the bright colours, because I think there's nothing worse than school buff clay with a, you know, insipid clear glaze over the top. It's very uninspiring. So, you know, these kids would be making beautiful, you know, flat tiles with gorgeous bright colours. And their excitement at seeing these pieces, you know, it made me want to do it again. And actually I'd kept all my stuff. So I must have, you know, subconsciously known that I would go back to clay. But at the time I'd had enough.
Mm-hmm. It can be very challenging, can't it? I feel like I keep being given the opportunity to learn patience, because clay requires a lot of patience, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Patience, resilience, and actually, when I pack a kiln, you know, my motto is, you know, always expect the worst, and if it's good, it's a bonus. You know, it's that's the way I look at it, really. So,
absolutely. Yeah. Now, what advice would you have? We've talked a lot about your journey, and you just talked a little bit about that period of time where you stopped, and then the bug got you again, which I'm grateful for. What advice would you have for a budding potter, somebody who is just getting going in the clay work?
Depends on what they want to do. If they're interested in throwing, I would say find a course, you know, like an intensive week's course or something. Because I used to teach evening classes, and, you know, people would come along each week for a couple of hours, and they'd really want to learn how to throw, but they only had a couple of hours each week. So by the time the next week came along, they were back, you know, still struggling to center or whatever. Whereas if you do an intensive course, you know, week's course somewhere, you know, you can practice, which is just what it needs. You know, you need time to, you know, do one, you know, take it off, do another one, you know, that kind of, and also have fun, because, you know, that's what it's about, really. It's, you know, playing for a living. I feel very, you know, very lucky to have it's more of a life choice than a job, you know, and the moment it becomes just a job, you know, that's, you know, it's not, you know, generally most people don't make a huge amount of money out of doing this. It's more that they have to do it. It's a passion. You know, if I haven't touched clay for a few days, I've become, you know, I've just got to get out there. So, you know, definitely practice, have fun, and, you know, just try and make what you want to make rather than what you think other people want to buy. Because if you always think, well, I'll need to, you know, I'll try and make this because I need to sell it. And if your heart isn't in it, it comes out in the piece. You know, if you enjoy making something, I think that shows in the piece. You know, I fill my pots with love, and hopefully, you know, people can get that from seeing them. I don't know.
I totally agree with you. It's the energy that we put into our work comes out in on the other side when somebody's looking at it. Yeah. So I agree. Georgie, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate you spending the time and the energy and sharing your ideas of how you make your beautiful work.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Bob. I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks. thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Color and Ceramics Podcast with Bob Acton and his guests. Please help others find the podcast by subscribing to this podcast wherever you find your podcasts, such as iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Music, YouTube, or other podcatchers. And don't forget to give us a review. We'll see you next time.